Hi,
Hey.
Mimi.
Good morning, Ramesh.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, all things considering with the new baby, which you understand as well.
Yep, we both have little girls. Yours is about a month younger than mine, something like that.
Just about that, yeah. So in, let's say, 2035, 2040, maybe they'll be doing their blogging heads.
Oh, I don't know. I think they might be a little faster than that. By then, it'll just be all it'll all be post tweeting. Whatever comes after tweeting, probably something with
Right.
10 characters or less.
Right. This whole hour-long discussion would be so 2011.
Nobody will have the attention span for it.
Yeah.
Well, you have written recently about the abortion legislation going through the House, and I've also written quite a bit about the general topic, although not as much lately. So I wanted to get your thoughts on what's going on in the House and what it says about the politics of abortion nowadays.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting. I think Ed Kilgore just pointed out in TNR recently that for all the talk of, whether there's a truce on social issues in the Republican Party so people can focus on the economy or, questions about whether Tea Partiers actually even care about issues like abortion. It really has never gone away, at least at the state level, where there have been all sorts of legislative proposals to put restrictions on abortion. And certainly in Congress, as soon as the new Republican majority came in, it was their top third bill. So, the right after repealing healthcare reform, putting through new abortion restrictions was the top priority of the new Republican majority. So, whether we expect it or not, abortion is here to stay as an issue. I don't know if that means that it'll be something that dominates 2012, but it's certainly dominating the congressional session. And the bill that just passed last week was an effort, well, there was an amendment by Mike Pence to defund centers like Planned Parenthood that provide family planning services, and it was essentially getting rid of all the Title X funding that Obama had proposed for his budget for next year.
Yeah, what strikes me about this now that you mention it, I mean, is that if you compare it to previous iterations of the Republican Party and the conservative movement, this one is more united on the pro-life issue. I mean, if you think back to the Contract with America in late 1994, they really didn't mention social issues. All they really had was a tax credit for families with children, but they didn't do anything about abortion. Last fall, on the other hand, the Pledge to America did include a provision about cutting off funding for abortion. And if you look at the presidential wing of the party, it's true you've got Mitch Daniels talking about a truce, but remember back in 95, 96, you had people like Weld in Massachusetts and Wilson in California, Whitman in New Jersey, all of whom were trying to make a serious effort to change the platform of the Republican Party on abortion.
Right.
Now, you certainly still have pro-choice Republican governors and legislators, but first, you have fewer of them, and second, they're not invested in changing the definition of the party. And I'd say, in a lot of ways, the field for 2012 looks more socially conservative than the field for 2008. There's nothing like a Giuliani type figure. I mean, Giuliani has talked about running, but he's certainly not going to be dominating 2011 the way he dominated 2007.
Well, I know we'll be getting into the 2012 possibilities a little later on, and so I'll be interested to hear if you think an issue like this can just disqualify somebody like Mitt Romney, who, while he may be pro-life now, certainly has gone through a conversion. But you mentioned something that I've been doing a lot of thinking about, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it because I'm not exactly sure what it means, but we really have just in the last 15, 20 years seen a division of the pro-life and the pro-choice camps into the Democratic and Republican parties. Whereas, you know, in 94, you not only had a fair number of pro-choice Republicans in the House, certainly not a majority, but you had folks like Susan Molinari. You had some, you know, fairly high-ranking Republicans who had to be dealt with in the caucus. But you also had pro-life Democrats. Now, they had been shrinking in numbers, certainly, especially since the 1980s. But especially after the rout last November of some pro-life Democrats, it's very hard now to find a pro-life Democrat in Congress. And it's nearly impossible, from what I can tell, looking through the voting records in the last Congress, to find any Republican who will vote on, you know, what appears to be a pro-choice line, at least in Congress. What's the upshot of that, do you think? Does it make it harder for, say, pro-choice members to actually have some influence when Republicans are in control? And the flip side, you know, is it much tougher for the pro-life line to get a hearing if Democrats are in control of Congress?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that it's not even just the last 15 years, really the last 30, 35 years. I think abortion has really led the process that's been called the Great Sorting Out, where you have the progressive elimination of liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats over time. Because, I mean, one of the things when I was doing my book on abortion and related issues, that really surprised me in my research was that as late as mid to late 1980s, Democratic voters were more likely to be pro-life than Republican voters were. And just over time, that has changed, really, I think, responding to signals from party elites in both parties, because Democratic congressmen were voting pro-choice more than Republicans already by the mid-70s. And I think it's just been sort of a process that has fed on itself to the point where, you know, if you're just sort of not culturally comfortable as a pro-lifer voting for the Democrats or as a pro-choicer voting for the Republicans compared to how comfortable people used to be. And I think absolutely it is true that if you've got a Republican House, pro-choice legislation is going to have a real hard time moving, and vice versa for the Democratic side. Although, you know, obviously if public opinion is strong enough one way or the other, there's a limit to that, right? I mean, if you remember, I'm sure the Democratic House, with a pretty lopsided Democratic majority, did vote for the Stupak Amendment by a pretty strong margin in the fall of 2009, before that was stripped out of the health care bill because it couldn't get through the Senate.
Yeah, but I guess I would argue that now after 2010, there isn't a Bart Stupak-type figure in the Democratic caucus.
I don't think something like that
would happen again.
Yeah, that might be right. I mean, you know, I thought there was a chance after 2006 you'd have a revival of pro-life Democratic fortunes. I mean, you had a real effort on the part of Rahm Emanuel and to a lesser extent Chuck Schumer to run pro-life Democrats in districts where that made sense. And that's why you ended up with Bob Casey, for example, having the field cleared for him in the Senate race in Pennsylvania. But I do think that the way the debate over the health care bill unfolded and the way the election went has really hurt the idea of a bipartisan pro-life caucus for some time to come. I think it is going to be a more Republican caucus, which I think is probably ends up being good for the Republicans and bad for pro-lifers.
That's interesting. Yeah, it does appear that the sorting out is almost complete in Congress. Not so among voters yet. I know I should have looked at the numbers for 2008, but the ones I have off the top of my head are that in 2004, a little over a third of George Bush's votes came from pro-choice voters, and slightly under a third of John Kerry's votes came from pro-life voters. So they still have people supporting candidacies of candidates who, you know, may not hold the same positions on abortion. But well,
of course, most
comes...
voters don't think of it as one of their top issues.
Right,
It's always a low-ranking issue in terms of how important people think it is in casting their vote. But I do think it affects these cultural cues. I mean, I do think, for example, let's say you're a Southern Baptist who has misgivings about prohibiting abortion, or maybe is mildly pro-choice. But, you know, the people you look to for guidance, the people who are your friends, elites in your community, largely because of the abortion issue, they have closed off the possibility of voting for these pro-choice candidates, and you're affected by that. And I think something mm-hmm. very similar happens among people who are maybe from more progressive religious traditions or not from any religious traditions, and maybe they have misgivings about liberal abortion laws, but they associate the pro-life position and pro-life politicians with people on the other side of a cultural right. divide from them.
Right. No, I think you're absolutely right.
Speaking of cultural divides, Wisconsin seems to be dominating the news as there is a little sort of a to the barricades kind of mentality, I think, on both sides now when you're mm-hmm. seeing sort of echoes of the 60s. I've heard some people talk about it as, you know, it's our domestic Spanish Civil War, which was probably a little overheated. What are your thoughts about what's going on in Wisconsin?
I guess my thought is, if this is happening in Wisconsin, we really need to be on the lookout for what's going to go on in other states. I know the state has changed a bit since its kind of populist heyday, but it's not the first state I would have fingered to have a showdown like this take place in. It seems to be having at least something of a ripple effect, at least if my Facebook page is to be a judge of anything from all of my Michigan friends and family who have kind of taken up the cause. I don't know if that's happening in other Midwestern states as well. But I don't know. We seem to be at kind of a standoff now. Maybe that'll change in the next couple of days before this even airs. But you know, it's hard to know who ends up winning right now.
Yeah, right now both sides don't seem to be budging. I suspect that fleeing the state, as the Democratic state legislators did, isn't going to play well. But I haven't really seen any numbers on the reaction of Wisconsinites. I think you're on to something about these upper Midwestern states where, I mean, I've long thought that these are ripe for realignment to the Republican side, and evidently, you know, the Bush administration, 2000-2004, the administration, even before that, the Bush people really made a play for Wisconsin, especially, and to a lesser degree, Minnesota and Michigan. And they were frustrated. They didn't win any of those states either time. But in the last election, you saw in Minnesota and Wisconsin and in Michigan, both houses of the legislature went Republican. The governors in two of those states went Republican. And in Minnesota, just barely failed to stay Republican. My working theory on this is that in 2012... Republicans actually have more of a shot at getting Wisconsin or Minnesota than they do at taking some of the states that they took in 2004, like Colorado, New Mexico, and Nevada, which seem, I think, to be moving the other direction, and where, for example, Colorado and Nevada had disappointing results for the Republicans in 2010. But what do you think about the general issue of public sector unions? I mean, my sense is that there are, at least in sort of the liberal intelligentsia or the center-left intelligentsia, there are some misgivings about the power of public sector unions. On the other hand, maybe I'm just reading too much Mickey Kouse.
Well, that could always be the case, I think. Yeah, it's certainly not an opinion that is shared across the Democratic Party. And it's not a case, you know, it's just, it's interesting because it is one of those things that has shifted. Some of that is the result of the sorting out that you were referring to earlier. You know, it used to be the case that if you were a union member or somebody in your family was a union member, you would absolutely be a member of the Democratic Party. And I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but, you know, certainly it has to be affected by shrinking numbers of union employees. But that is no longer the hard and fast political rule that it used to be. And even less so, I would imagine, among people who aren't themselves members of unions, but, you know, have family members. That used to, you know, influence you just as strongly as if you yourself belonged to a union. But particularly with the economy the way it is now and people losing, say, their private sector pensions when companies are going under, there is kind of this sense of resentment that I haven't seen before now, at least not to this degree. And so I think it is going to be a little harder to maybe rally support. Although obviously, you know, you've got however many tens of thousands of people who are sleeping at the Wisconsin Capitol. But that said, it's still not a party-wide issue, I think. And that contributes to my sense of just not knowing how this is going to end up playing out. Although, you know, it could be that it's something that is really firing people up. In Wisconsin, particularly the longer that their kids are going out without teachers and without school, you know, it depends who they end up blaming for that.
Right. I guess part of the question here is, the political question is, do most folks in private sector unions, to what extent do they think of public sector unions as sort of fellow union members, and how much do they think of them as public sector people who are subsisting on their tax dollars? Because you could see that going either way, and I guess that's what, you know, that's got to be one of the crucial political questions, because if the Republicans succeed in putting the emphasis on public sector rather than union,
right,
you could really break the union solidarity that's a key component of their political success. I mean, I guess my thought on this has always been that, you know, public sector unions are a source of frustration and an obstacle for conservatives, but it's sort of a dilemma for liberals, because liberals really want a government that can be flexible and responsive and hold the confidence of the public that it can meet all these challenges. And the public sector unions, on the one hand, increase the political ability of liberals to get their legislation passed, get their people elected. But it also, I think, reduces that sense of governmental efficiency, competence, and flexibility that's really important for liberalism to retain sort of a hold on the public.
Yeah, I think we're probably producing a boring blogging hits here, because I agree with you on that as well, that you know, it does pose a huge dilemma for Democrats, and it's one of the things that's been playing out as particularly, you know, the issue of teachers unions has gotten a lot of play with President Obama and his willingness to kind of encourage taking them on. And questioning, you know, whether somebody should still have a job if they're just not effective at what they do. And at the end of the day, as much as a lot of people like to support the idea of unions, the reality of somebody being able to retain their job when they're simply not either good at doing it or doing it at all, I think it's harder to support, again, particularly now in this economy. It's maybe something people are willing to turn a blind eye to when everybody's doing just fine. But it becomes much more of a flashpoint when these people are getting your tax dollars and you're not doing so well yourself. So I don't know. I definitely could see this becoming something that extends into next year. Certainly not the showdown in the Capitol, at least I hope not, unless they have really stocked up on their supplies over there. But as more of kind of a broader issue, about what is government. You know, it was something that President Obama really laid out in his State of the Union address, making what I thought was a pretty good case for liberalism, or at least, you know, one of the really comprehensive, more public defenses of liberalism that I'd heard in a long time, that, you know, sometimes you need government, and sometimes government can be good, but you need government to be efficient. And I could see, you know, a very effective critique of that coming from the other side. And that would actually be a really interesting campaign debate to have. You know, I would certainly prefer a campaign that revolved around arguing those two positions than a heck of a lot of the ones we've had recently.
Yeah, I'm sure we'd both prefer to the campaigns we're likely to actually have in 2012. Well, how do you see that race shaping up? You know, on the Democratic side, for example, it seems like the talk of a primary challenge to Obama has died down a little bit over the last month or two. But is this something we're going to hear more about or actually even see?
I don't know. Given how excited people get about you know, the possibility of conflict, particularly on the Democratic side, you know, anybody who sticks their head up and says they want to take on the president is bound to get some media attention. But I don't think there's any serious possibility of a primary challenge, certainly nothing like 92. I don't see that taking place. And on the Republican side, man, it's hard to think of another year in which we were this close to the primary starting and we had absolutely no sense what the field's going to look like at all. You know, I'm really of the opinion that Newt Gingrich is not going to run, Sarah Palin is not going to run, Mike Huckabee is not going to run. I think my former colleague Karen Tumulty had a piece in the Washington Post recently about you know, she went up and talked to Mike Huckabee and asked, you know, why would he run? And I think that's exactly the right question. Not why not, but what is it, what would there be for him? You know, I think that's right for Palin, too. And he's got a nice life. He's building a big house on the Florida coast, and he's on TV, and he's eating again and doing speaking engagements. And, you know, why would he want to give that up?
Yeah, I mean, I think she has a lot to lose. I mean, there's a serious chance if she runs in the primaries, she loses. I think more likely than not, she loses. And, you know, that's bad for the brand. On the other hand, if she sort of toys with it, if she's sort of the person who could have won the nomination and has that, you know, solid bond with her her hardcore base, that is a lucrative position to be in. I mean, I think actually if you think about it this way, Michelle Bachmann has only upside if she runs for president. And I think she is going to run for president. She will build a national fundraising base. She will get attention, get her point of view across. And then at the end of the day, Minnesota's filing deadline is such that when the presidential race is over, she can go back to running for her House seat, and she'll be in a strong position. My only disagreement, though, with what you've said is I think Gingrich is running. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why he's running, but I think I think I'd put some money on it if I had money to put on something. All the indications I'm getting are that he's running. I get very mixed signals about Huckabee. I don't know whether he's running. I think there are two reasons why this race is getting off, as you said, to a slower start than usual. One is that the primary rules have changed to encourage states to hold their contests a little bit later, and that may be lengthening things. The other thing, and I think it's more important, is Fox News. So many of the Republican candidates have contracts with Fox News. They can reach more people in Iowa and New Hampshire by staying on the airwaves than they can by going in there and campaigning. And if they announce their campaigns, they lose their contracts, they're not getting paid anymore. So why not reach more people and get paid for it? And I think that's, you know, that's something that almost all of these candidates are finding a calculation that's pretty easy to make.
Yeah, and it's something we haven't seen before.
And it's totally new.
It's one reason why I think those three, and you would be more plugged into Gingrich world than I am, although I've been amused that every time he makes what seems to be a political statement, he's also plugging a book or a movie or something. So I think this will he or won't he run has been a very effective way for him to kind of build Gingrich Inc. And I also, I guess I'm old enough, as you are, to remember the 98 campaign, where Democrats did nothing but feature Newt Gingrich in all of their ads. And it was pretty darn effective, because nobody liked Newt Gingrich at that point. But it's one reason why I think they are better off as kind of perma candidates who don't actually end up running, because it's a much better life to be on Fox News, to have that contract, to be able to make lots of money going and being the featured speaker, to be kind of a more legit Ann Coulter figure. That is, you know, to be a public Republican and a prominent Republican, but not somebody who actually has to govern or, you know, God forbid, be running around Iowa eating corn dogs.
Right.
You know, and if that's the case, then I think the Republican Party is in trouble, because who's actually taking on the hard work of not coming up with, you know, fun sound bites that are going to, you know, be inflammatory and get lots of attention, but, you know, who's actually doing the hard work of sorting through policy positions and being ready to be president. I don't know who you end up with then.
Yeah, you know, and the other question is the Republican nomination going to be worth having in 2012?
Yeah.
And I think that's just an open question. I mean, I think a lot depends on what the economy looks like in mid-2012, and it's, you know, it's very hard to say that right now. But it could certainly, I mean, I would say, so, you know, if the economy is maybe slightly better than it is now, I would give Obama, you know, better odds of winning. I'd say he'd have to be favored to win. You know, the power of incumbency, some structural problems on the Republican side with turnout compared to the Democrats in presidential years. And I also just think, you know, there's this basic, that the Republican message of 2010 worked perfectly well for a negative campaign based on depriving the other side of unchecked power, but they don't yet, I think, have a message, nationally at least, that's capable of yielding a majority that says, yeah, we want the Republicans to govern. And that's what they would need to have in 2012 to actually win the White House.
Right. Right. What would that case look like?
Well, gosh, I'd be being paid big bucks as a Republican strategist if I knew that one.
You know, I ask that somewhat seriously because, you know, most of what we've heard from the right over the last few years has been, you know, on the attack against Obama and against Democrats. And I guess, you know, I know this isn't something you hear explicitly from a lot of folks in the Republican Party, but it's certainly a line that has been encouraged. And if Obama really is this, you know, closet Muslim who's a socialist communist who hates America and wants to take it down, don't Republicans have a patriotic duty to take him on and get him out of the White House in 2012? And if they're not doing that, then is all of that kind of fear-mongering about him not really real?
Well, I mean, I think Republicans do have a patriotic duty to take him on, even though those things aren't, in fact, true. I guess, you know, one thing that really that strikes me about the Republican posture right now is, to the extent that there's a message and an agenda, it's a budget message and a budget agenda rather than an economic one. There really isn't any sort of macroeconomic policy other than the idea that if you rein in spending, you might reassure creditors and stabilize the markets, which seems to me, you know, it's when you've had previous Republican wins in bad economies like 1980, for example, there was a much more sort of thoroughgoing economic agenda And you really just don't see it right now. The question, I guess, was going to would be whether any of these presidential candidates start developing that kind of agenda, because it doesn't seem like it's going to come out of the congressional wing of the party. And as long as the race is kind of frozen by Fox News, maybe you don't see that emerging for a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, we did hear Mitch Daniels at CPAC start to make something of an argument that goes beyond the budget. What do you make of him? I mean, he's certainly not your typical winning, charming presidential candidate, but he does seem to be serious, which may mean he's dead in the water for either party. What is your sense of him?
Yeah. You know, you're right. Governor Daniels and Governor Pawlenty in Minnesota have both tried to broaden the message a little bit, although the program is still very much kind of spending cuts, spending mm-hmm. restraints first. Governor Daniels reminds me a little bit of Phil Graham in the 1995-96 race, in that he had a lot of support from the conservative intelligentsia. He was running on a... on the idea of government cutbacks, not so much on the idea of tax cuts, which you know, he left to Steve Forbes and other candidates, mm-hmm. Not so much on the idea of social conservatism, which, you know, he went to Colorado Springs and told James Dobson, "I don't want to be a preacher," which is sort mm-hmm. of his equivalent of Governor Daniels' famous truce. And, you know, it didn't actually get him very far when it came to Republican primary and caucus voters in 96. And I kind of think Daniels is destined for the same eventual fate, that he's, you know, people who, you know, write for magazines like National Review and the Weekly Standard are really interested in him. But I'm not sure how much actual voters are going to go for him. And I'm not sure mm-hmm. how serious he is about running or what, if he is, the campaign strategy is. I don't see what, you know, leaving aside whether it's a good or a bad idea, and I tend to think it's a bad idea, I don't see what the political point of musing about a value-added tax is, for instance, as Governor right. Daniels has done. And the social issues truce, I mean, if you're trying to communicate to people, look, you've got other priorities other than the social issues, but you're going to be a social conservative mm-hmm. when you have to make a decision, which is, I gather what he's trying to get across. There are 100 ways to get that message across more deftly than he has done. Hmm. You know, because I swear this will be my last thought on this before letting you have the mic again. But it seems to me social conservatives do not expect the Republican presidential nominee to share their priorities. And in fact, that's never been the case. McCain, Dole, both Bushes, Reagan, at no point have any of these folks had the priorities of a Christian conservative in Iowa. But they do expect their leaders not to go out of their way to say, by the way, your priorities aren't important.
Right, which is one of the things that kind of did in McCain in 2000, was that very in-your-face speech in Virginia Beach. You know, telling at least the leaders of the religious right.
Agents of intolerance.
Right. No interest in them. Yeah, I guess, you know, I see George W. Bush a little different in that he both knew how to talk to social conservatives and also fairly effectively convinced them that he did share their priorities. I think that was one reason a lot of social conservatives were so surprised and not in a good way. After the 2004 election, and that they very much thought that he was going to turn around and start pushing their issues, particularly on gay marriage. And when that didn't happen, started to feel somewhat disillusioned in his second term. But you're right that, by and large, that has not been something that Republican voters have demanded of their candidates, just, you know, to be taken seriously and treated with some respect, which is slightly different. And if that's the case, then, you know, what does that mean for the 2012 field in terms of who might be the candidate the social conservatives get behind? Because kind of the assumption of pundits has always been it's going to be the person who is closest to their positions and their priorities. And I think it's one reason that, you know, I've thought if Mike Huckabee had taken a little more seriously in 2008 and had been at less of a huge fundraising disadvantage. He really could have taken that nomination from McCain, who, you know, was not, certainly to put it mildly, the first choice of the conservative voters in the Republican primaries.
You know, I'm really surprised by the number of political journalists and political operatives who say similar things to what you just said about Huckabee, that he could have had the nomination. And even I hear from some people that he would be a strong general election candidate. And I don't believe either of these things. Because, for one thing, he can't unite social conservatives because he has next to no appeal, or at least the version of him that ran in 2008 had next to no appeal to Catholic social conservatives. He ran a campaign that was really geared towards getting evangelicals to vote for him as a fellow evangelical. Mm-hmm. And if you looked at the exit polling data and looked at how he did among non-evangelical voters in Republican primaries, he was routinely placing behind Ron Paul. I don't see how, with that voter profile, you can get the Republican nomination, let alone a general election in the end. I think it's a strong enough component of the Republican voting electorate that it's tempting to go down that road, but it's also self-limiting. And this leads me to another point, which is that every time there's a contested Republican presidential nomination, people wonder who the social conservatives are going to get behind. And as far as I can tell, they've never coalesced behind a single candidate early on. Maybe as the race develops, you know, with the Bush versus McCain thing, when it comes down to a two-person race, maybe that'll happen. But there's never a candidate who's sort of the social conservative candidate, only the social conservative candidate, who goes anywhere in the primaries. There's always either there's an evangelical candidate who can't get the Catholic social conservatives, or all the social conservatives have, you know, a foot in each camp. And I think that's, you know, you're going to see that kind of pattern again this time. Pawlenty's going to have some appeal to social conservatives. Daniels will, even though he talks about a truce, have some appeal because he's got a good socially conservative record, and on with the others.
Yeah, I guess I'm not talking about, you know, who would be the one candidate going forward so much as that deciding decision-making block that you talk about, you know, in 2000, making the difference between Bush and McCain. I think that's where social conservatives really do have some power in the primaries. And, you know, there's also, you know, as you say, it's not necessarily the case where a candidate has to prove themselves to be the socially conservative anointed one. But it's also been seen, at least within the Republican Party, as a must to have kind of the blessing of some leaders in the religious community.
You have to be acceptable.
Kind of interesting things to track in 2008 was the variety of candidates, the different leaders were getting behind. What was it? Pat Robertson was endorsing Rudy Giuliani, and Mitt Romney was getting all sorts of evangelical endorsements, even though that didn't help him, as nobody thought it would, to get the folks in the pews. And a couple other people, I think, got behind Fred Thompson, which didn't go anywhere. And it ended up not being the deciding factor for John McCain. But in another race, it could be.
Well,
We could go round and round on this. I actually had wanted, before we run out of time, to hear you talk a little bit about a piece you wrote a few weeks ago about the possibility of Palin versus Romney primary that shakes out in the end, and your fears of what that would mean for the Republican Party. Can you just kind of lay that out a little bit for our viewers?
Sure. I think that, you know, look, I mean, these Romney and Palin are in the polls the top contenders for the Republican nomination. I don't think that people have really focused on what, if it came down to a race between the two of them, what that would look like, or how destructive it would be to Republican chances of winning. in the 2012 election, and even really to the party beyond it, because they really, in a way, kind of embody the divisions in the party in a way that you just haven't really seen in a primary contest before. Every fault line in the party would be exposed. I mean, for one thing, and this is something Raihan Salam and I have written about in National Review a couple months ago, there really is a new class divide in the Republican Party, because you've had this influx of lower middle class voters, people without college degrees, and you've already seen a division in the polling where those folks prefer Palin disproportionately, and people with college degrees who are Republicans disproportionately favor Romney. And you can really see a kind of class element of this division, with the, you know, sort of the Palin side kind of resenting pointy-headed Ivy League intellectuals, and the Romney side sort of looking down on these kind of backwoods yahoos, to, you know, sort of maybe paint this a little more starkly than it actually is. But I think, you know, primaries tend to accelerate these sort of stark divisions, and you could have a lot of problems there. And it's not, you know, I don't want to make it sound as though it's all driven by Palin and the sort of resentment. You also have the fact that Romney has never demonstrated any appeal to voters who aren't affluent. I mean, if you look at the exit polls for him, he was not getting pluralities until you were hitting voters who made more than $100,000 or $150,000 a year, who are a factor in Republican primaries, but there aren't enough of them. And I guess my concern from the standpoint of somebody who thinks the Republicans, who probably would want the Republicans to win next time, is that you could end up with a nominee who is just fatally damaged with a slice of the electorate that he really needs, or she really needs. Palin already has a problem with college-educated voters, and I think a primary fight against Romney would probably make that worse. Mm-hmm. And Romney has a problem reaching out to middle-class and blue-collar voters, and the primary would probably make that worse, too. So my concluding thought is that there do seem to be a lot of Republicans at all levels of the party who don't really like either Romney or Palin. And if you're in that camp, you probably should be solidifying behind an alternative pretty soon, because as we've both been talking about, there actually isn't that much time to go.
Right. Although, you know, thinking back to the spring of 2008, everyone was talking then about Barack Obama's problem with blue-collar voters and, you know, whether the protracted primary campaign against Hillary Clinton was just going to make it impossible for him to win anybody who wasn't college educated and affluent in the general election. And that turned out not to be a fatal problem for him.
Well, yeah, I mean, my own guess, though, is that Hillary would have done better, particularly among blue-collar whites. And part of the, the fact that Obama didn't have a problem seemingly with that vote, although there was some erosion, was Lehman Brothers, was the whole financial crisis and panic. And you have seen serious defections from the Democratic Party in 2010 among that voting bloc, which makes them, I think, a real key demographic for next time around.
True, although, you know, it's just so hard to draw any conclusions from 2010 and also from 2008. You know, one of the things I kept looking at that year was obviously where different religious blocs were breaking down. But I don't think, you know, we could conclude from 2008 because Obama won Catholic voters, which, as we both know, is a ridiculous kind of category to put all Catholics into. But that no more means that he, you know, has won Catholic voters back to the Democratic Party than 2010 means they've all left the Democratic Party for the Republican Party. Those are, you know, swing voters who are going to be putting their economic interests first and foremost, as they should. And I don't think we yet know with good certainty what party is going to be best positioned to appeal for, to them in
2012. Well, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to follow up on that, because I think I'd be very interested in what you have to say about this, because there is a school of thought that says it's not meaningful to think in terms of a Catholic vote at all. Catholics vote like everybody else. They always vote for the winner, yes. Which shows that they're not a distinctive voting bloc. And I keep pushing back against this by saying, well, actually, most groups of voters and most individual voters don't always vote for the winner. That is, in fact, part of what's distinctive. That, yeah, there's obviously a lot of differences among Catholic voters, but they do seem to swing as a group more than other voters. And in fact, they swing more than the general electorate does. But you know, again, I'd be interested in hearing whether you think that there is something distinctive, or for political sort of practitioners, something worth thinking about differently with respect to Catholic voters.
I think that there is, and I think that it very much matters what the hierarchy, and in the U.S. the Bishops' Conference decides to highlight in terms of issues. Because it makes a difference if you know, your local priest is talking about immigration as an issue that matters to Catholics. It's been something that the Bishops' Conference has been really involved with, trying to urge immigration reform in the last couple of years. You know, they've urged people to send, I think that was one of the issues for which there was a postcard campaign to send postcards to members of Congress. You know, we usually only hear about that when it's a postcard campaign to contact people about abortion. But
I think I saw those postcards at Mass once.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, I think I saw those postcards at Mass once.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that makes a difference because it, you know, just raises up to a higher level, something that's a political issue and connects it to, you know, religious beliefs and Catholic social teaching. You know, it's certainly not something that I think is being emphasized by a lot of Republican candidates, and I would be very interested to see now that we have a huge increase in the Republican caucus in Congress of Catholic members, whether there's any sort of pressure by the Bishops' Conference to start moving in a different direction on immigration, the same way that there is on, you know, pro-life Democrats, where they still exist, on abortion issues. There's a potential to move people on those issues, and we've seen, you know, 2006 is kind of the election I keep going back to, because nationwide, Democrats did nothing to try to target different groups of religious voters, at least. But in a couple states, like Pennsylvania, where it helped because Bob Casey was running, and in Ohio and Michigan, where the state parties really decided to sit down with groups of Catholic leaders, evangelical leaders, and just kind of talk about where they were coming from and solicit concerns, you saw a movement of 10 to 15 points among Catholic voters and evangelical voters for the Democratic candidates that was not matched across the board nationwide. So it wasn't just attributable to 2006 being a good year for Democrats, which I think shows that it is possible to really reach out and target those voters. It's just something that Democrats tend not to do. And I think Republicans do with a very broad brush sometimes.
Are you of the view that the Obama administration has sort of let this fall by the wayside after maybe the spring of 2009? I mean, I know some folks who are really, really eager to have the Democrats engage with religious communities think that since Notre Dame, the administration just for whatever reason hasn't done as much and that this has been a mistake. I think E.J. Dionne, for example, falls into that camp.
Yeah, I guess I have been surprised that after really looking into religious outreach and building up a pretty big group to do that at the DNC after the 2004 election, after 2008, that kind of disappeared in the Democratic Party. Nobody.
And you think it would have been a natural for Tim Kaine?
I'm sorry?
Oh, it would have been a natural for Tim Kaine.
I think it's ridiculous that Howard Dean was much more invested in religious outreach than Tim Kaine was, because it was a big part of his win in 2005 was being able to figure out a way to make his identity as a Catholic part of his political image, and also make him seem more appealing to independent voters and voters across the aisle, because he was willing to take a politically unpopular stand, like opposition to the death penalty, and attribute it to his religious beliefs. You know, it was one of those weird cases where taking an unpopular stand actually made him seem much more authentic to people and made them willing to take his faith much more seriously. Whereas if he'd just done the pandering thing, it wouldn't have paid off for him the same way. I know I'm not going to try to speculate whether there are policy stands that Obama could have taken to try to deal with the perception problem that he has among a lot of voters, and particularly conservative voters, about his faith. I found his National Prayer Breakfast speech very interesting. I think it's the most candid and open he's ever been about his faith, and probably the most candid speech we've ever heard by a sitting president about their faith. And you could detect kind of a slight, slight note of frustration from him, that it just bugged him that he had to stand up and do this to prove to people that he actually was a Christian. And understandably, you know, if you're a Christian and but a third of the country thinks you're Muslim, maybe it's less than that now, a quarter, you know, it would be kind of annoying to have to stand up and say I am too what I say that I am. But, you know, it's going to be a significant issue for them in 2012, and I don't think it is helped by the fact that they have kind of set religious outreach to the wayside for 3 years, because it makes it look like you're just targeting people during a campaign year.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see how this goes, and I hope we'll have another opportunity to talk about it on Blogging Heads.
I'm sure we will.
Thank you so much. This was a fun conversation.
It's been good chatting with you.
All right. Take care.
All right. You too, Ramesh.